We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. And Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Well, you know, it's not possible to be online just about any time and pretty much any place. And, of course, more and more people are living more and more of their life online and putting all sorts of information about themselves out in the world, doing things online like sending messages back and forth, but also doing business, banking, all sorts of things where there is personal information involved. And the thing you also have to keep in mind is that that kind of free access and that kind of use of the internet can indeed pose risks to you, to your computers, and to your personal data. Well, this is October, and October just happens to be National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and we thought it would be a good time to talk about that very issue, to do a little review of the basics of computer security and invite questions. And that is what we're doing this morning with our guest for this hour. His name is Brian Mertz. He's an outreach specialist with CITES, that is Campus Information Technology and Educational Services, on the U of I campus. And he spends certainly part of his time traveling around here, the campus, and trying to do education on these very subjects. So we're really pleased that he could be here. We're inviting whatever questions you have on best practice online that has to do with security. So not any computer question, but specifically this one thing, which I think over time just has become more and more important. So, indeed, those kind of questions, give us a call and he will do his best to help you out. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Why, just maybe as a general question, I shouldn't even have to ask this question, but as a general question, why does this matter? Particularly, I'm sure that there are some people who might say, well, if in my work I'm dealing with information that's very sensitive, I want to keep that secure, my employer wants to keep that secure, well, okay. Mm-hmm. But in so much of their routine things that people do, they might say, well, why is it really that important?
Well, I think it's obvious for businesses because they sometimes can lose things like trade secrets, other things that can have definite dollar costs for their business. But at the same time, there's definite dollar costs on a personal level. If your credit card is stolen, you know, most credit card companies will be able to walk back the charges, but on average, we see it takes about a year and a half for someone to fully recover from the effects of identity theft. You'll be spending time watching your credit card, monitoring. You might have to work harder with your bank to secure your accounts. On the very small level, it just becomes a constant hassle. On the very extreme level in terms of effects, lots of money can be lost. Your credit score can be driven into the ground. And I think most people understand from that point the implications of that kind of attack.
Sure. And I suppose that on the extreme end, though, the way that people would react to this and might say, well, if that's the way it is, then maybe I don't want to have anything to do with the internet. I just don't want to go online at all, which maybe is a bit of an overreaction.
Yeah, I think it's an overreaction. And I think it's becoming more difficult to do that. I think even to some extreme, there are certain applications on the internet it's becoming harder to avoid. I think Facebook, for example, it's not so much an issue of are you on it, but are you not on it? And what are the consequences for not being on it? I think a lot of our legislators and the market itself is sort of envisioning a world where that's going to become part of everyday life. Having a mobile device that connects you and allows you to instantly pay for services, whether it's parking fees or your coffee in the morning or whatever else, that all involves computer security. Because if you're not taking care of that device, if you're not protecting, you know, what you do with your account information, if the business isn't protecting the information they gather about you, it has consequences all across commerce. And I think the more that commerce moves towards an online connected model, it's just going to become an inescapable part of our lives.
Yeah. Well, let's run down the basics. And I think that that what people will do is if you just, as I did, if you just go online, you do a Google search for cybersecurity basics or computer security basics, you're going to get essentially the same list of things. So let me ask you about some of these things.
Sure.
And I want to start out by talking about passwords. A huge annoyance to a lot of people, I'm sure, because there are so many things now that require passwords. And it and if you have to remember a lot of them, that's a problem. And the one of the standard pieces of advice is, well, don't write it down on a piece of paper and, you know, put it under the blotter on your desk. You don't want to do that. And you want to have it be a good password. Well, let me ask you about that.
Sure.
What makes a strong password?
Well, when passwords started out, a good password was something that people couldn't easily guess. It wouldn't be your password, or I'm sorry, it wouldn't be your birthday or, you know, a family member's name. It could be a word someone wouldn't know. Identity thieves have gotten much more sophisticated since then, and they now have programs that, in a matter of seconds, can start running through thousands of words in the dictionary. And these programs are fed different dictionaries. So it might be the English language. Some of them are starting to use foreign languages. Some of them are starting to have dictionaries where common letters are interchanged with numbers. So you might take the letter S and put a 5 in its place. Some people do that to make their password a little more complex. These programs, the better the dictionaries get, it drives how complex your password needs to be. So what we recommend now for people is that they have a password that is at least 7 characters long. It needs to have uppercase and lowercase letters. It should have at least one digit, a number in it, and it should have a symbol, like an ampersand or parentheses. The more complexity you add to your password, the longer it will take for those password programs to figure out what your password is. The upside for that is that in today's sort of marketplace, a lot of people are still using really bad passwords. The most common password is still password, followed up by 123456. You just want to avoid being the low-hanging fruit when it comes to passwords. If you have a password that's strong enough to stump one of those password programs for a few hours, unless you have some information that's very specific to you that someone wants, the average identity thief will move on to an easier target. They know there's someone out there that has a much easier password to guess. So that's kind of the advice we give right now. As this, you know, cat and mouse game progresses, passwords are going to need to get longer. They're going to need to get more complex. But for now, again, 7 characters, uppercase and lowercase, numbers and symbols.
Yeah. The other thing that maybe that though can make this easier for people is that maybe there are a number of different things you do that require some kind of password.
Mm-hmm.
They may not all have the same level of security. So with your banking, that's one thing. But if it's something that you're using to access some kind of, you know, website you go to, like recipes.com,
yeah,
well, maybe that's not quite so critical.
Yeah, we say, you know, if you have a password for, let's say, fantasy sports, cooking sites, anything that you don't mind the rest of the world knowing about you, it's fine to reuse a password for that site. When you get to the more critical sites, like your financial information, you need to use a password that's strong and it needs to be different. Your email password should be entirely different than every other password you have, because just stop and think about if someone had unfettered, unlimited time to look around your email account, what could they find there that's already there? What could they do with that email account? What other accounts could they go and reset? Most times when you reset a password, they send the new password to an email account. Well, if someone has control of your password at that time, they have control of everything else as well.
Yeah. Okay. It's not a good idea to just say, well, I have a hard time remembering passwords, so I'll just have one and I'll use it for everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. The Gawker had a major breach a few months back, and what it showed was there were a lot of people reusing usernames and passwords. So there was a long list of usernames and passwords that were published, and people just took those usernames and tried them on different websites, seeing if, you know, that combination still worked. You don't want to make that easy, because the sites that usually do have, you know, less important data, like a food website or a fantasy baseball site, they may not take as much time to secure that information as well. as your bank or your credit card. But if it's the same password, you've lowered your defenses down to that lowest common denominator, and you don't want to do that.
Now, here at the university, the sites requires people to the password, the basic password they need to log on to their computer and do all the stuff that they do, requires people to change that at least once a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all at least doing changing it once a year. Do you recommend that people change that, change their important passwords more frequently than that?
That's a big debate within the security community. It's very split on what the real usefulness of that is. It is important to change it at least once a year. And I would say if you are comfortable with it, several times a year. Some people advocate as much as once a month, and that just seems like a recipe for confusion.
Yeah.
But the point is, if you don't reuse passwords, that need to change a password becomes less. Because if you just have one secret password for one specific site, it's much harder to guess that from putting pieces together about you.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Brian Mertz. He's an outreach specialist with Sites Security. That's the Campus Information Technology and Educational Services here at the U of I. They are our computer gurus. If we have problems with computers, they're the guys that we go see. And he's been good enough to talk a little bit with us here this morning about security issues with computers. You use these kind of devices to go on the internet. You deal with personal information. You want to make sure that your computer is secure, that someone cannot hijack it for their own nefarious purposes. That's what we're talking about here this morning. And questions are certainly welcome. Basic security questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you would like. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have some folks here on the phone to talk with, so let's do that. The very first is someone in Mattoon, and they're on line one right here. Hello.
Hello again.
Yes.
In the promos to the show, I thought that I heard mentioned that you were also going to be discussing the cloud and storage in the cloud. Could I ask a cloud-related question as well?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. My question was, you know, I finally have gotten to the point where I understand what the cloud is and how to use it, and I have been, but given the password discussion that you just had, saying, you know, okay, I use a strong password, so it's not my fault, how secure is the content that we put on the cloud? And a number of companies now are beginning to offer cloud storage. Amazon does, Apple does, and a number of others do. Google's beginning to offer it for their units. Does it matter which company you go through if you have to go through a company to do that?
I think it absolutely does matter. And in terms of the answer to your question of how secure is it, it matters by the company. Dropbox actually a few months ago had a pretty bad security breach where the content of every single user that use their storage service online was made public. And so it really does matter that before you sign up for a cloud service that you do some research, Google the service, and don't just look for the web results, but look for the news results. Look to see if they've been involved in any kind of major data breach, and then use that to sort of inform your opinion. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, I just signed up for Dropbox, although I haven't moved anything to it yet. So that's kind of a not very good news to hear.
Well, and that's something to think about, that we want people to understand that a large part of information security comes with knowing what information you're putting out there and where you're putting it. So if you were going to use Dropbox for something, let's say that wasn't very sensitive or couldn't be very damaging to you, that could still be fine. I wouldn't recommend putting, let's say, your tax returns or something like that on a site like that that's had problems. And now this is not just to, you know, pick on one company. It's something that even security firms have had major data breaches that call into question their ability to protect that information. And I think it's something that we're going to see a lot in the next year, especially. Congress is very much swept up in this issue. We might see some new laws coming out of Congress, possibly, that would help businesses understand what their responsibilities are for protecting information. Because right now it's sort of up to the business to do it themselves.
Well, I know, like, an organization that I'm a member of, we use Google Docs so that we can share documents. And, you know, is that safe?
Yeah, I mean, Google Docs generally has been pretty safe. The most common problem we see with Google Docs is more a user error problem where because Google has an autofill option for sharing documents,
right.
Sometimes people will send it to the wrong person. Sometimes they'll make a document available to the entire world by accident. So as long as you're watching, you know, the permissions within Google Docs that you're setting for each document, being careful about who you're sending documents to, Google Docs is actually a very secure way of sharing information.
Okay. And what is your opinion on websites where, you know, once you've logged in, they give you the option to stay signed in? Do you recommend, you know, not doing that?
I personally do not recommend doing that, staying signed in. It's something that it comes down largely to, in my mind, your view of privacy and where privacy law is going in the future. And I think there's some people out there that really embrace that new technology. They really love that, you know, they can get informed opinions based on where they've gone on the web. And other people, frankly, find that a little bit creepy. And I kind of tend to lean more towards, I guess, the creepy side. Not so much because of what the companies are doing, but it's just hard to guarantee that a company can keep all of that information safe all the time. Even the best intentioned companies sometimes can lose that data. So again, we really do stress that people understand what kind of footprint they're leaving behind online. They have control over that footprint to some degree, and it's really up to each individual to find their comfort level. We find a lot of younger people, you know, their views on privacy is they're comfortable with it. They're fine that these sites know this about them, and other people don't. So as long as you're not putting sensitive data, you know, stuff like your social security number, credit cards, other real basic stuff out there, where you go on the web, that's sort of an individual thing we leave up to people to decide.
All right. Well, thank you very much for all your time and your help.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that these kind of issues that the caller raises, as we have more and more people offering the convenience mm-hmm. of accessing the web and your personal data with small portable devices, mm-hmm. tablets, smartphones, stuff like that, where the data is stored in some kind of remote place, and all you're using that device for is to mm-hmm. get to that place, this is going to be more and more of an issue.
Absolutely. And I think what we're going to see a lot of these hardware devices becoming is your sort of authentication piece, mm-hmm. where this device proves that you are you and you are supposed to have access to this information. So, you know, physically protecting those devices is going to become more important in the future. But I think this is a topic that is only bound to become more of a common issue. Facebook has a new service called frictionless sharing, where if a website, let's say the Wall Street Journal opts into this, I believe they've actually turned it down, but they were approached by Facebook to offer this option where if someone was logged into Facebook, every article they read on the Wall Street Journal's website would just be automatically posted to their Facebook profile saying, you know, this person was reading this article. That's the type of environment some of these companies want because it makes it easier to sell to advertisers specific mm-hmm. information. And then they see that advertising revenue as their way of offering a free service. You know, when you download a free app for your phone, it's never really free. It's usually tracking something about you that can then be repackaged and sold to an advertiser or a marketing company.
Okay. Well, we have some other calls. Let's talk next with someone in Lovington. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
My question was kind of along the lines you were talking about the doing business on it. My impression is that a lot of the kids are from the other end. From the company you're doing business with. It seems like I get a new credit card every 3 months now, and I just assume that's because my number's been compromised. Maybe I'm wrong. How much insecurity, I guess, does it add? I don't go online to check my balances. I don't have a relationship with my companies online. how much more security do I really have? That's, I guess, what I was wondering about.
So you're saying that you do most of your stuff offline, most of your business and financial work offline?
I don't have any accounts that I check on or have a relationship with the bank online.
Yeah, that still to this day will probably remain one of the more secure forms of doing transaction in today's economy. There's always the concern that your bank or your credit card might experience a data breach. But if you're just, you know, dealing with either going in person or using the postal service, that still to this day remains very secure. One thing I would recommend, though, you mentioned the credit card applications that you've been receiving.
It's not applications.
Oh, it's cards.
It's the same credit card company giving me a new card every month.
Oh, I see.
It's 10 years ago, I'd wear the card out and I'd call them up and I need a new card, you know, and a lot of it would have the same account number on it. Now it's like every 3 to 6 months I get new cards with new numbers on them. I just assume it's because MasterCard's had their security breached again.
Yeah, and that's actually very possible. If they're sending that, it might be in response to a data breach. It might be in response to they might have a new technology built into the card. But it is something we have seen where credit cards get reissued at a much faster rate than they did before. But in a way, that's actually a good thing. If they're taking the time to monitor your account and give you that kind of response, it's much more preferred than the opposite, where bad things might be going on and they're really not getting back to you in any way. So, but I would say if you're offline and you're comfortable with it, just stay that way as long as you can, if it's possible.
All right, thank you.
And it is true. I don't know if this is what you're thinking about, but it is true that if people are constantly getting in the mail, getting offers mm-hmm. of credit cards, one of the things that means is whoever it is that's extending you that offer has checked your credit.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible for you to do something about that so that you don't get that stuff if you don't want it.
Absolutely. And actually, we do warn people that when you get those applications or you get pre-approved cards, you know, that someone, you know, that you could just stick back in the mail and get a card, we really strongly recommend shredding those documents. There have been reports in Champaign County of people, you know, going through dumpsters, retaping together credit card applications that have been ripped in half, and credit card companies are so eager to have credit cards in people's hands that they will accept applications that have been torn in half and taped back together. So really shred those documents so they're not usable again, because you don't want someone taking out a credit card in your name and then having to go through the hassle even of just explaining that wasn't you. That's not an easy process to prove to a credit card company.
Very good. Let's go to Champaign. This is another caller here, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Going back to passwords for a second, I wanted to ask you about these programs that I've seen. There's a lot of freeware versions of this online, of software that will remember passwords for you. I've found a version I find has some security features where the program itself can be just installed on your computer or your laptop, but there's a file that could be put on a thumb drive that has to be present in order for the software to function, and then there's a master password that has to be used to gain access to the program, and then once you're inside, it will either remember the passwords you already have set up or will actually generate random letters and numbers for you to use as a password, and then if you just double-click on it, it'll put the password in your computer's copy and paste memory for 10 seconds and then wipe it out. Do you have any opinion for software like that?
Yeah, we actually, if you're a member, if anyone listening is a member of the University of Illinois community, we actually offer a program very similar to that called Password Vault that's available for free from our web store download. But in general, those programs are a really good idea. We like the idea of having a strong master password to get to other passwords that you want to set and forget. One of my coworkers always uses the example of her student loan password, you know, has to deal with that account maybe once or twice a year. Instead of writing a simple password that's easy to remember, it's a difficult password, and you use one of these programs to remember it for you. I hadn't heard of one before that has the USB feature to it, but that's a great additive incentive, because if you keep that USB key on you, even if someone gets access to your computer, and let's say they somehow guess your master password, they still couldn't get to that program. So that's a really nice service. The one caveat I would offer, though, is that before you use any of those programs and install all your passwords, make sure you do some research about the product, Google it. The IT community, the IT security community, is actually very active on Google in terms of the results that you get. It's a great IT support if you don't have someone else to ask specifically. So Google the product you're thinking about using and see what people have said about it, because you don't want to be feeding a fake program all of your passwords and having that program then collecting your passwords and sending it to someone else.
Right.
But if you do your research, we actually strongly recommend that kind of program to help remember tough passwords.
Now, the password vault that you mentioned available to the university community, is that a paid software?
It might be paid to the public. If you are part of U of I and you have a UID login, you get it for free. So we provide that in our office to the campus. But
do you know of any free or very reasonably priced versions of that for the broader community that you could recommend?
I do not, but I have my laptop with, and if we have a break coming up, I can quickly see if anyone in my group has some recommendations that we can maybe put out on air later on. But we are so used to recommending Password Vault to U of I, I haven't really looked beyond that. But it is a good program. I don't believe if there is a cost, it's very high, so it might be worth investing in.
The program that I mentioned with the USB feature is called KeePass, with key spelled K-E-E.
Okay.
And I only mention that because it is freeware. I don't think it would be benefiting anybody by mentioning it on the air.
No, and I've actually heard of KeePass before, so it's a reputable program.
Okay, excellent. Well, like I said, that's freeware, so if there's any listeners that are not part of the university community, maybe that would help them.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you. We are talking this morning, and as part of Focus with Brian Mertz, he's Outreach Specialist with Sites Security. That's the Campus Information Technology and Educational Services here at University of Illinois. And we're talking about computer security issues. We thought it might be a good thing to do to just try to review the basics. This is month when now for a number of years now, the government is trying to get people to think about that. Mm-hmm. This is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. So we thought, well, good time to be doing that. Now, we'll take some more calls. We have some more people calling in, but we'll take some more calls after a short break. This is Focus.
You think that money is everything?
That's Seth MacFarlane, creator of the animated series Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about comedy, and we'll listen to his unironic new album, in which he sings relatively obscure music from the American popular songbook. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of Public Engagement, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give is on the web at ccfd.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow, in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Nicholas Christakis. He's professor of medical sociology at the Harvard Medical School and also professor of sociology at Harvard University. We'll talk about human social networks in real and evolutionary time. He's going to be here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk. Also, then the second hour tomorrow, we'll talk about some current issues in journalism, and particularly talk about some of the challenges that people who have newspapers and who publish newspapers are facing now in the cyber age. Mizell Stewart will be our guest. He's the editor of the Evansville Courier and Press newspaper, and he'll also be here visiting the campus, talking with the journalism students, and will talk with us tomorrow morning at 11. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. We also always welcome questions, comments from people who are listening. You can check up on future shows, listen to past programs by going to the website will.illinois.edu. This morning in this hour, we're looking for questions on cybersecurity for individuals, things that you can do to make sure that you're safe when you were online. And our guest is Brian Mertz. He is outreach specialist with sites security here at U of I. So do you have an answer for that last?
I do have an answer. Password Vault, there is a light version that is available for free. Just Google Password Vault and it will show up. It's produced by LavaSoft is the company that makes it. But that's the program we recommend for storing passwords. But again, any password protection program that encrypts your passwords and is from a reputable company is a very good idea.
Okay. All right. Very good. Back to the phones here. By the way, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's someone to talk with in Fithian. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I have a satellite hookup with WildBlue, and they have an F-Secure as their virus protector. But my computer still gets slower and slower and slower, and I've tried CCleaner, and I went to the Microsoft's website to get their recommended protection, and F-Secure doesn't like it. And I've sent samples of, you know, they ask you if they want to send a sample to F-Secure, and I have, and I haven't heard back from them. Anyway, do I have to take the computer in to get fixed, speed it up, or is there anything other than CCleaner or something? Because it usually doesn't find anything.
Sure, there's possibly a few issues going on here. First of all, sometimes when you're given antivirus software from a company, so let's say you buy your computer at Best Buy or even this, you know, satellite service you have, they only give you a short subscription service. So they might give you 30 days and then the program stops updating itself, which, you know, is an attempt to get you to purchase a full subscription. So that might be one thing to check if you haven't done that already. Another program you might want to give a try, and it's extremely popular with our help desk and our security staff, is a program called Malware Bytes. It's all one word. It's bytes with a Y. It is a program that does a really good job of finding very tough-to-remove viruses. There's two types of antivirus software. There's one type that will protect your computer. It'll watch what's coming and going, what's happening when you go to websites, when you download a new file. It's sort of your day-to-day protection. Malwarebytes is in another class, and it's more of a removal tool. It assumes that you have a problem already that you can't get rid of with another protection service. And so it'll do a good job of finding some really nasty viruses that can slow down your computer. So I would recommend downloading that. It's free. Running that, it's usually pretty quick, even with a very full computer. It can be done scanning in about an hour or so. And let that run. And if it finds anything, it'll delete those programs. We've seen computers experience a pretty considerable performance boost if they've got, you know, a pretty nasty virus that's the source of everything slowing it down. If you run Malwarebytes and your computer still continues to run slowly, that might be a point where you need to bring it to someone so they can take a look at some of your other settings. But as a first, you know, attempt, if you want to just try to fix it yourself, Malwarebytes is a really good program to use.
Okay, that's fine if F-Secure lets me download it.
It should. It's a reputable program. If for some reason F-Secure is not letting you download it, that would be a point where I would actually recommend turning off F-Secure for a moment to get Malwarebytes onto your computer. There's no danger in running that program, so you can disable F-Secure for that time and then re-enable it once you have it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, no problem. Thank you. This is something that is of course going to be on the standard list of things to do for security, mm-hmm. as that is to have antivirus protection for your computer. If you go online, you need to have this, and you need to make sure that either it updates itself or that you look for updates and make sure you always do updates that are available.
Yeah, and most antivirus software these days is set up to auto-run. It would be a real pain if we expected someone to go get new definitions every day, and they really do come out every single day because there's new viruses every day. But I actually just read two recent reports that say updating your software is just as important as running antivirus software. So when Windows sends you updates, it's really important to turn those on. I saw one study that said if you were to keep updated your Flash software, your Java software, your Adobe Reader software, and Internet Explorer, just those four things, when those updates come up, you will block about 99.8% of the viruses that are delivered by the most common virus tool set out there. Yeah. And that tool set is responsible for about 88.5% of the viruses in the wild. So those four programs are so problematic that if you can make sure you take care, again, of Flash, Java, the Adobe products, and Internet Explorer, you're going to go a really long way in having a safe experience online. If you don't keep those up to date, if you don't run your Windows updates, it can be a matter of hours of being online and being on actually sometimes seemingly harmless websites. You don't have to go to the dark, seedy sides of the internet to get a virus on your computer like you used to.
And it seems that that's a good thing to mention, because I'm sure that there are people who are thinking, well, those updates, they're just to have new features, they're to make sure that maybe it works a little bit better. But indeed, there is a security angle to that.
Absolutely.
And if one of those companies, if you're using that software and they say, hey, we have an update, do it.
Yeah, there's nothing exciting about announcing a security update the way that, you know, when Apple announces a new operating system, it's, ooh, look at all the bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. But most updates are in response to very specific security threats. And a completely patched Windows computer can sit outside a firewall, can sit open in the internet, and studies have shown it's just not going to get affected in most cases. So really, those updates are probably the most crucial feature you can do to protect your computer.
Okay, and also, you should have a firewall. If your computer comes with one, turn it on.
If you've got a Mac or a Windows computer bought in the last 5 years, you have a firewall. It's sometimes with Macs, they're not always turned on. By Windows, they're turned on by default. Keep it on. It's a really important protection.
Very good. Line three, here's another caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I use Norton 360, which is a pay-for annual subscription-type security package. Mm-hmm. And on that package, they have a feature that you can enable that fills in passwords you've told it to go ahead and save. It'll usually ask you when you create a password if you want to save it, and you can. If it's just some frivolous thing, usually it's you tell it no. What do you think about programs like Norton 360?
Well, on its own, Norton 360 I think is a really good security program. I think that autofill feature again comes back to thinking about what information you're providing with people. So. Is that a desktop computer or a laptop computer?
No, it's a laptop.
Okay.
And the autofill, understand, is part of Norton 360.
Okay. The laptop component of it would make me personally give pause to turning on autofill, just because laptops are so much easier to walk off from you. And you don't want someone being able to get onto your computer and have their lives be any easier to get to any of your accounts.
Right.
Now that said, again, going back to our examples from earlier, if you have passwords for a fantasy sports site, a cooking site, you know, everyone seems to have a password requirement now for their website. Those more harmless sites, it's okay to have that autofill. I think most newspaper sites that I have bookmarked, I have my account logged in and automatically, because no one's really going to cause me any damage. But I would never... No matter what program is asking me, I would never turn on autofill for my email, for my banking accounts, my credit card accounts, my HR accounts that I have at the university, anything that could cause me real damage, I try to make it as difficult as possible for someone else to get access to it.
All right. Well, thanks for the information.
All right, thank you. Very good. Thank you. Somebody wrote in an email about password creation that I think is, you know, I at least want to ask you about. This person says, well, it's actually easy to create a password that you can remember because she suggests that you take a song title, take a song that you know and you like, and take the beginning letters of each word. And her example is the song I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus. So what she says is if you take the first letters and then you alternate between upper and lower case, and then if you toss some numbers in there, that's going to be pretty strong, and that probably will be easier to remember than something that's completely random.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a great system. For a while, we used to recommend people swapping out letters and for numbers, and like you could swap the letter E out with a number 3 because they look somewhat similar. Mm-hmm. They've gotten identity thieves have caught on to that, so. That method is sort of dying out. This is great, though, because that the song title part is something that only you would really know. No one would sort of start guessing that. And even if they did know what songs you liked, if you didn't tell anyone that was your method, that's great. I've seen some people recommend that you have a block that's the strong components of a good password. So, you know, the letters, the numbers, the characters. And you memorize that block, and then you attach a word based on the account to the beginning or the end of it. So you could have that block and then have baseball for your baseball site or something like that that accomplishes the same thing. But I think that song mnemonic is fantastic.
All right. Well, here's another email and something that I wanted to try to make sure that we touch on. And as I mentioned before, now that there are a lot of people, more and more people are using small portable devices, smartphones and tablets. And as far as I know yet, there's no antivirus software available for a smartphone or for an iPad. Now, there's a market there for sure. someone writes in here, well, is there a need to be security conscious with your tablets like your iPad as with your computer? The person asked the question, do you know if there are antivirus apps for tablets? And my understanding is no, there aren't.
That is one of those. Security is a cat and mouse game in the truest sense. So in this case, we are very much behind the virus writers. I just read an article about a virus that if you visit a certain page on your phone, it will automatically download viruses to your phone and then start sending text messages to premium phone numbers that charge your phone bill $6 a text. And it drives up money for the person on the other end of the text.
Sure.
So they're out there. We do need people to think about their tablets and their phones much in the same way as they would with their computer. When antivirus software finally does catch up and is available, you're going to want to have that on there. Whether you have an Apple product or a Google product or anything else, you're going to want that. Updates, as always, you need to update your phone. That's the way that a lot of these companies right now are providing security, is they're providing it through their phone updates. You need to have a password on your phone. The same way where you should have a password on your laptop for login in case someone steals it, they can't quickly get on to your laptop. With your phone, if you don't have a PIN on your phone and it goes missing, think about what someone could do to a phone that has your email already set up for instant access like people usually do on their iPhone. If you work for a business and you access files from your mobile device, they would have instant access to that. Your whole phone contact list is just a whole lot of information stored on there. So you need to have that login password. And with mobile devices, there's two other things we recommend. There's tracking services that you can download for both iOS and Android. And we had a robbery that got some press in Champaign this past week at an Espresso Royale cafe. Mm-hmm. And that is a situation where tracking on the device might have helped recover it. And then you also want to have a remote wiping system. So if your phone or tablet goes missing, something will erase that data. There's programs you can get that you can trigger data erasal over your computer from anywhere. I know that the iPhone has built into it an option where you use the password system, and when a certain amount of passwords are incorrectly tried, it will erase all the data on the phone. Most people, when they're stealing phones or tablets or even laptops, they're doing it to resell the hardware. And so that part we don't really worry too much about. We worry about where the device ends up, who ends up buying those devices, because the people buying these devices are usually the ones looking more for what's on the computer, what's on the tablet. So it's a very real concern, and unfortunately, the marketplace is behind the hackers. They're behind the identity thieves right now, and it's going to have to catch up in the next year. It really is, because it's so easy to spread viruses on your phone, and it's a lot harder to tell when your phone is infected than when your laptop's infected.
Yeah. So do that. So it, even though it maybe seem like an inconvenience, you should set it up so that you have, even with your tablet or with your phone, or even with your laptop, that you should, it shouldn't just be on.
No.
You should have to log in.
And I think about my phone, it takes me literally a second and a half to enter in my password. And I think about the trade-off of a second and a half of my time versus the financial and professional damage that would come if my phone got into the wrong hands. And that's an easy trade-off in that situation to pick the password.
Yeah. There's also, I think, a standard kind of recommendation for desktop machines, at least for machines in a work environment, mm-hmm. that if you're going to be away from your computer, you know, you get up to go to the bathroom, mm-hmm. you should lock it.
Yeah.
So that no one can come along real quick and sit down in your place and start.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us have our email programs to set, launch the second we log into our computer. If your programs are all online, they're already open, everything's logged in, how much damage could someone really do with even 10, 20 minutes in front of your computer is what I think people need to get into the mindset thinking about.
We have maybe about 5 minutes left here. I have another caller in Tolono, so I want to get right to them. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have two questions. One is, how quickly is a virus discovered and companies are able to correct for it? And two, if you have it like an extensive host file, how does that help keep you out of trouble? Thank you.
Bye. Sure. I think viruses, it varies on the virus. If it's a virus that's actually been able to spread to a lot of computers, those are usually responded to a lot more quickly. But even on the individual virus level, it's back to that cat and mouse game. We'll see, security groups offer solutions, and then the virus writers will have found a way around that solution, sometimes within hours. Apple had one of its first virus outbreaks. It released a solution, and literally that same day, the new version of that virus was working around them. So that's a kind of ongoing struggle. And if it's a relatively unknown virus, there was a famous virus called the Stuxnet virus that was actually used to target nuclear reactors in Iran. And that went sort of under the radar and kind of understood for a few years until we got the full picture. And even now, we don't really know who created that virus or what it could have done. To answer your other question, the host file, the more complete and more up-to-date your virus software is, the better chance you're going to have of catching stuff. But really, and this was just a fascinating thing to sort of learn, was just that the patching system, those updates you receive from Microsoft in particular, they're far more responsive to what's really out there than we thought. Those sort of zero days, what we call them, the very cutting edge, no one's seen this before virus that you hear about in the movies, that's not what is infecting people. Some of these viruses have been infecting computers for years, and it's just that people haven't updated their computers in years. And so really, the more up-to-date you are with those patches and those updates, the better you are against viruses.
Okay. A couple of things I want to make sure, again, we mention here with email. I guess now most viruses are coming through emails, which didn't used to be the case.
Well, actually, it's kind of sort of a little bit reversed. We're seeing some of those emails, they're more likely to send someone out to a web page that will have a virus. Back in the day, we used to have viruses spread by email attachments, and those still do happen. But places like U of I has gotten really smart about blocking emails that have those attachments. scanning the attachment for virus before it gets to the person's inbox. Years ago, even just like 5 or 6 years ago, we used to have one person on campus open an attachment, get a virus, and then suddenly that virus is emailing everyone in their address book. Well, some people, that could be, you know, half the campus. And so in an afternoon, we would have a widespread outbreak that would just, you know, cause chaos for the day. So people are actually spreading stuff now a lot through links. You know, they'll have fake videos on Facebook, pictures, websites, all sort of stuff that work around these built-in defenses that a lot of companies have put in place.
So that's it. I guess it just the bottom line is there are people out there who want you to click on stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what they're trying to do, is get you to click on stuff. So how do you think before you click, do I actually want to do this?
I mean, we stress two questions. We think about what information you're giving away and who are you giving it to. And we really encourage people to picture themselves in real life situations. If someone came up to your door and said, hey, I've got this video for you to watch. Can we come inside and, you know, put this DVD on your DVD player? And you had no idea who this person was whatsoever. Most of us would, you know, either politely or rudely shut the door and go about their day. Somehow when we're in front of a computer, that caution disappears. So really think about who is giving you the link to look at. Make sure it's from someone you know or someone you trust. Even in those cases, though, if it seems out of the ordinary that you would be receiving this sort of video, if someone says, oh, I have video from the party we were all at last night. Well, if you were at home, and even if that was someone you know who said that, a virus might have taken over their account, and it might be using their account to send out this message to fool other people and infect other people. So it really does come down to just some basic common sense. Think about what you would do in the real world, how you would interact with that person and that, you know, question they're asking you.
Yeah. And again, in about 30 seconds, if you're at some sort of public Wi-Fi hotspot, you need to think very carefully about what you're doing.
Yeah. Now, if you're using if you can easily hop onto a wireless network for free, that means people with bad intentions can also easily hop onto that network. And if your computer is not protected, they can very easily see what you're doing on that network, see what websites you're going to, steal your passwords, steal your credit card. So be careful in those public Wi-Fi
sites. And there again, that's for at least for people who are here, work for the university, the sites has a thing particularly for that.
Absolutely. If you go to our security website, security.illinois.edu, we have tips for working out of the office, setting up your home wireless, and other things like that.
All right. A lot of good information available there on the site's site. So that's CITES, Campus Information Technology and Educational Services. Our guest, Brian Mertz, is an outreach specialist with Sites Security. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. Receiving this sort of video. If someone says, oh, I have video from the party we were all at last night. Well, if you were at home, and even if that was someone you know who said that, a virus might have taken over their account, and it might be using their account to send out this message to fool other people and infect other people. So it really does come down to some basic common sense. Think about what you would do in the real world, how you would interact with that person and that, you know, question they're asking you.
Yeah, and again, in about 30 seconds, if you're at some sort of public Wi-Fi hotspot, you need to think very carefully about what you're doing.
Yeah, now if you're using if you can easily hop onto a wireless network for free, that means people with bad intentions can also easily hop onto that network. And if your computer is not protected, they can very easily see what you're doing on that network, see what websites you're going to, steal your passwords, steal your credit card. So be careful in those public Wi-Fi sites.
And there again, that's for at least for people who are here, work for the university, the sites has a thing particularly for that.
Absolutely. If you go to our security website, security.illinois.edu, we have tips for working out of the office, setting up your home wireless, and other things like that.
All right. A lot of good information available there on the site's site. So that's CITES, Campus Information Technology and Educational Services. Our guest, Brian Mertz, is an outreach specialist with Sites Security. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign County Developmental Disabilities and Mental Health Boards, presenting the 5th Annual Reaching Out for Answers Disability Resources Expo at Lincoln Square Village on Saturday, October 22nd from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Learn more about information and resources available for people with disabilities.
That's it for us for Focus Forward this morning. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. 1 minute before noon Central Time. In Kansas City, December wheat, 709 1/4. That contract is up 1 3/4. March, 724 3/4, up 1 1/4. December wheat in Chicago, 624, up 1 1/4. March, 658 3/4, up 2 1/4. December corn, 642, up 2. March, 653, up 1 1/2. May, 660 1/4, up 1 1/2. July, 664 1/2, up 1 1/4. November soybeans, 1258 1/4, down 11 3/4. January, 1265 1/2, down 13. March, 1272 3/4, down 13. May, 1275 1/4, down 13 3/4. December soybean meal, 326 even, make that 325.90, down 170. December soybean oil, 52.98, down 56.